Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome all the members back to the club, and hope you're enjoying your membership. And if there are any new members, we hope that you really enjoy your membership. And the club, for the new members, the club puts on over 400 events a year. And out of those 400 events, the Humanities Forum puts on about 40. We always like to tell you about the ones that are coming up. And before I do that, I'd like to remind everybody to turn off these things, these devices. As you know, we record everything. It's always nice when your grandmother's call gets into the recording. So what's coming up is our month of August. We're having a platform called Music Matters. For those of you who have been in the club a long time, you kind of are aware that almost every August, if not every August now for about 10 years, there's a theme for the month, and there's a lot of lectures about around that theme. We have to make August as sparkling as possible in order to distract people from the weather. So we have Music Matters coming up, and the Humanities Forum is actually having 5 events out of the 30 events on Music Matters. We have a wide range of ideas about music. So the first one we have is on Wednesday, August 5th. We have Kip Crana. Those of you who are familiar with the San Francisco opera scene know him. He's been a fundamentally valuable person in connecting with the public about opera in San Francisco for decades. And he's a great speaker. And his title is Who's Afraid of Opera? He says, you know, this is a kind of outrageous art form. How did it get started? Why is it so popular still? Why is it something that you know, is so over the top in expenses and that you know, everybody has to, the tickets, even though they're high, don't cover the cost, even half the cost. So anyway, very entertaining, a big fan of opera, but very realistic about it and very funny in discussing it. So that's Kip Crana on August 5th, Who's Afraid of Opera? I'm going to be speaking on August 10th, next Monday, as part of our Monday Night Philosophy series, which this lecture is also part of. We meet the second Monday of every month on some topic or another. Tonight, it's about the deep history that Ian Morris is or big history, either one. They keep changing their title. That Ian Morris has set trends for, and I'm sure many of you have heard him speak here before. This is the third or fourth time, right, that you speak here at the club. I'm going to be speaking on Pythagoras' thought music matters. For those of you who are familiar with Pythagoras as a philosopher or as a mathematician with the Pythagorean theorem, but a lot of people aren't aware that he is instrumental in Western music coming out the way it did, because it was his mathematical studies trying to find where numbers were everywhere that noticed that there's a mathematical relationship in the octave between the length of the string, that if you double the length of the string, then you have another different octave. And as a result of that mathematical observation, he also saw all other kinds of mathematical relations between the strings and the vibrations, and that's where our other harmonies come from, not just the octave, but all the other ones. So he's fundamentally right at the beginning of Western music and how Western music divides from other forms of music. And he also used it as therapy for mental illness and many other things, you know, that he used it for. So anyway, that's what I'm going to be talking about. And that's Monday, August 10th. On Monday, August 24th, we have a music teacher from the Berkeley Public Schools coming in to explain why music education didn't disappear. When all the funding was cut, either parents came in the case of Berkeley, the city came in and funded it itself. You know, they voted for a tax and how that works and everything. So that will be explained, and also, you know, a little bit about how music education is working in the schools today. And on August 26th, Wednesday, the same week, we have Steve Machtinger coming. Those of you who have heard his other lectures on Mozart, where he brings his quintet in and talks about Mozart's ideas and then plays a piece and comes back, says a little bit more about it, plays some more, then plays the other parts of it. So that's really, we asked him to come back as part of the series. And what he's going to talk about is Mozart and Masonic semiotics. Now, it's a nice thing, but he was a Mason. And there were several ideas, Masonic ideas, which he incorporated into his music, and he's going to explain how he did that. And on Thursday, the day after that, August 27th, we have Mahesh Kali coming. He spoke here once before, a couple of years ago. He's an Indian classical music singer, and he's going to speak about changing times in Indian classical music. So His thesis is that although from the outside people think that Indian classical music doesn't develop or it's the same and it's just an ancient tradition and so on and so forth, he says that every big change in Indian culture has created a change in Indian classical music, and he's going to also talk about how globalization is causing a change in Indian classical music as well. So those are our five lectures for August. For our Monday Night Philosophy series on Monday, September 14th, that'll be the second one after this one, we have John Minderman coming, speaking about crime and punishment. Very interesting, very lucky man in some ways. He was about 10 years on the SFPD as a policeman, and then he was hired by the FBI. And one of the first months that he was in FBI headquarters in Washington, D.C., having been moved out there, got a call that there was a break-in at the Watergate complex, that he had to go and investigate it. And he was one of the first people there, and then, of course, went through the whole thing. So you can't get any closer to history than that, and a very interesting guy. So he's going to be speaking on his book, In Pursuit. So thought I'd mention that one. And we have a whole bunch of others. It's interesting, we also have a couple of professors speaking just 4 days before that, on Thursday the 10th, Jeffrey Raymond and Nikki Jones, and their topic is analyzing police encounters with the public, some methods for reducing the use of force. Obviously, one big issue that's been going on, they've done research for the last 10 years. They just published the research a couple of months ago in time for the wave of interest in how difficult these decisions are for the police and, obviously, for the civilians. So that's a few of what's coming up. And now I'm sure everybody has this off. If there aren't any questions, we will get started. Great. Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. And if you have any questions about the Commonwealth Club, we're available at www.commonwealthclub.org. And tonight's speaker, Ian Morris, is someone I've had speak many times. Very, very interesting ideas about deep history, big history, about how humanity has evolved. First talk that we had was on why the West rules for now. Great topic, great title, great book on it. Now, tonight's topic is foragers, farmers, and fossil fuels. And it has an interesting correlation between the values of those different societies and how the moral values, the ethical values of those societies, of how they relate to the fuels that are being used and how this is causing confusion in our current society where we're dealing with the past of all those things rambled up together. So without further ado, Professor Morris from Stanford University. Thank you very much for coming.
Well, thank you, George, for that very kind introduction, and thank you to everybody for coming along. Coming along on such a beautiful evening when you could be out there having a lot more fun. And it's nice to be here, and this is my first time in your new digs, which all looks very nice. And you even have some quite convenient parking just around the corner, which makes it perfect. So, well, okay. Now, let's see if I can make the slides work. I'm here this evening to talk to you about a new book that I published just a couple of months ago called Foragers, Farmers, and Fossil Fuels. And it's based on a series of lectures I was invited to do in 2012 at Princeton. At Princeton University, they have this organization there called the Center for Human Values. And they got all this money from the Tanner Foundation. And every year, they bring somebody out to give the Tanner Lectures in Human Values. And it's a great honor to be invited to come and do these lectures. And so I was sitting there at home one day on my computer, and this email showed up from the Center for the Study of Human Values inviting me to come give this lecture. And my first reaction was, oh, great, this is good. They obviously think I'm an incredibly important and interesting person. Then, though, I thought, there is one little detail here. I have never in my life written a word about moral philosophy. I've never even sat in a class on moral philosophy. And as far as I can recall, I've never opened a book on moral philosophy. So what's going on here? Why is this going on? Well, the reason it was going on, the problem with these things is, it's a big honor. You can't really say no. But I was slightly anxious about this. So we exchanged a few more emails. And it became clear from these emails that the reason they had invited me was, in fact, all the things I just told you, was that I had nothing to do with moral philosophy, but I had written this really annoying book, which moral philosophers really hated. And one of the great things about the Center at Princeton is they can get any moral philosopher in the world they want. So they regularly invite the very top people. But they also like to invite really annoying people. And so everybody can have a big argument and a big fight. And I clearly fell into this really annoying category. As George was saying, most of my work is about archaeology and very long-term history. I'm very much on the materialist side in the historical profession. I think material forces and geography drive almost all the story. And in fact, the editor of the Tanner Lecture Series, who write this little preface that goes in the front of the book when it comes out, he suggested that after my visit, they should relabel the Tanner Lectures on Human Values as the Tanner Lectures on Brute Material Forces. So I felt I had done my job there. But the reason they invited me was when I was writing a book that George mentioned called Why the West Rules for Now, I kind of, looking at big chunks of history, I kind of came to the conclusion that, the way I put it in the book was that each age gets the thought it needs, that people are very flexible, very malleable, we respond to the challenges and issues in the world we actually live in, and we tend to sort of stumble our way toward the basic sets of human values that work best in the age that we live in. So I thought, well, great, they're inviting me to give these lectures. Here is this opportunity to expand on this theme, which I think when you start tracing it out, it does pose, if I'm right, does pose a serious challenge to what moral philosophers do, at least what a lot of them do. They're interested in identifying like the best ideal set of moral values, the values everybody should hold to be good people. And if I'm right about it, the job is a little bit more complicated than that. So I gave these lectures, wrote this book, and I felt that this argument I had all kinds of implications, which I address at some length in the book itself. But this evening, what I want to do is talk about one set of implications in particular. Now, I'm sure you are all familiar with the notion of the 1%. It'd be kind of hard not to be aware of this if you're awake. Many, many people have had much to say about the 1%. Now, for all I know, you have to be a bit careful talking about this in the Bay Area, because a remarkable proportion of people in the Bay Area belong to the 1%. If you have enough money to retire on, you belong to the 1%. You may be getting paid by the state or whatever it might be, but you are having the income as a retiree equivalent to having probably millions of dollars in capital locked away. If you can retire in San Francisco, you are one of the 1%. Now, you will all be familiar with the criticisms of the 1%. This is a rarely seen picture here of the Occupy Palo Alto movement. You might not have been aware that such a creature exists. One of my graduate students, who actually just recently defended her dissertation, was very active in the Occupy Palo Alto movement. But, of course, there are similar movements going on. I will resist the temptation to make cheap jokes about the Occupy Palo Alto movement. But similar organizations all over the country. Now, I'm sure many of you will have spent at least some time talking about the kinds of issues that the Occupy movement and the critics of the 1% are raising. And increasingly over the last year or two, the discussions have started to focus around arguments made by a French economist, a guy, again, I'm sure many of you will be familiar with him, Thomas Piketty. Here he is, here, holding forth. He has become so influential that the quotation I wanted to use from his book is actually available as a ready-made PowerPoint slide on the internet. That is how you know you've made it. So what Piketty says in his book, Capital in the 21st Century, that came out in English last year, it sold 1.5 million copies, hugely influential book. Piketty says, when the rate of return on capital exceeds the rate of growth of output and income, as it did in the 19th century and seems quite likely to do again in the 21st, capitalism automatically generates arbitrary and unsustainable inequalities that radically undermine the meritocratic values on which democratic societies are based. This is Piketty's core idea. And he, being an economist, he boils it down to a three-symbol equation which tells you everything you need to know about the world. And the equation is R is greater than G, where R stands for the rate of return on capital and G for the growth of the overall economy. So if you've got a couple of million bucks stashed away somewhere, your wealth is going to grow faster than the wealth of the economy as a whole. The rich get richer, the poor get poorer. This is the Piketty thesis. The only force that prevents the rich just getting richer and richer and richer and the poor getting more and more downtrodden, the only force, he says, is war, mass violence. And he illustrates this with a huge collection of statistical evidence. But his major point in his argument, if you can all see the picture here, the red line on this graph is dates along the bottom here. The red line on the graph shows you the rate of growth of world economic output, you know, steadily going up until the great financial crisis sets in. Steadily going up, the blue line shows you the rate of return to capital holders after they paid their taxes and other extractions from them. And the rate of return to capital is massively higher than the rate of growth. The rate of growth of return to capital massively higher than the rate of growth of the general economy, except for this period in the middle of the 20th century, where we get the two world wars, which burn up a lot of the accumulated capital of the rich. In order to make the social coalitions that make war fighting possible, the rich are kind of forced to agree to much, much higher levels of income tax. In Britain, where I grew up, when I was a little boy, the top marginal rate on the income tax was 99%. And it wasn't that much lower in the US either back in the early 1960s. So he says, war is the one thing that closes the gap between the blue and the red lines. As the two world wars recede into the past, we see the blue line catching up with the red line, once again overtaking it as we go forward into the 21st century. This, says Piketty, this is really bad. Here is another of his graphs showing you the amount of total income in the society being captured by the top 10% of the population from 1913 through to 2003. And again, it's basically the same point. There's a massive bite out of it in times of the Great Wars. And since the wars have faded into the background, particularly since the late 70s, the share going to the richest 10% steadily goes up and up. So this argument then, major impact, very, very widely known, very, very widely debated. Now, I had the pleasure of meeting Thomas Piketty back in November. Here we are, a conference in Beijing. Here's me, here's Piketty. Very, very nice guy, very interesting guy. He gave a great talk there at this conference, a packed audience of Beijingers. Had them eating out of the palm of his hand. The audience was extremely enthusiastic. I did wonder a little bit what it was exactly about his talk that people were so enthused about. It wasn't entirely clear from the questions whether people are saying, well, great rapid economic growth like we've been seeing in China is going to undermine itself by polarizing wealth and everything's going to be terrible, or whether what I suspect actually the lesson people felt they were taking away was, you capitalist dogs in Europe are all doomed. This is going to affect you but not us. Wasn't entirely clear. But then we went off to, there was like a little lunch meeting after that. And there was something happened that has happened to me now a number of times when I've given talks in Asia, where you give a talk to a big room of people and everybody just makes you feel so good. They're all so nice and the questions are so supportive and positive. And then you go to the small group discussion and they tear you to pieces. and my suspicion is they don't want to make you look bad. So they save all the hard questions till you get into a small room. And this is kind of what happened in this little lunch group session after Piketty's talk that day. Chinese income inequality, of course, has surged, as many people know, surged since the death of Chairman Mao. This graph shows you income inequality being measured using a system I'm going to be talking about quite a bit in my talk this evening. It's called the Gini coefficient of income inequality. And what this is, it's a measurement on a scale from 0 to 1. 0 means a society has a completely equal income distribution. So it's like we pool all of our income and we share it out exactly. Everybody has exactly the same income. So that's a score of 0. Score of 1 means we pool all of our income and we give it to me. And now I've got everything and you've got nothing. And for a couple of days, I think that's great, but then you all starve to death, of course. So then I have a huge problem. But 0 to 1, 1 complete inequality, 0 complete equality. Lower the score, the more equal the distribution of income. And so this is 1976, China at the death of Chairman Mao, score of 0.31, as we'll see in a few minutes, very low score. By 2003, it soared to 0.47. It then dips down a little bit, down to about 0.46, but it's stayed stubbornly around 0.46 since 2009. Chinese income, distribution of Chinese income has become much less equal. And yet most of the people in the lunch group felt that on the whole, the Chinese economy, this was before the recent stock market meltdown, of course, but felt the Chinese economy was ticking along pretty damn nicely. They pointed out a number of times in the discussion, you know, Deng Xiaoping told us, to get rich is no sin. So what are you talking about? So what Piketty said, one of the things he said in the discussion, he says, there's nothing bad per se in accumulating a lot of wealth. His point, he said, inequality is not necessarily a bad thing, but there is such a thing as too much inequality, and that is a bad thing. Now, that got me thinking in our discussion. I mean, if there's such a thing as too much inequality, then does that imply there's also such a thing as too little inequality? Does it imply there's a right amount of inequality? If there is a right amount of inequality, how would we know? How would we know we've got the right amount? How would we know if the right amount changes? Well, this is where I come into the story. Like I was saying, I'm, you know, by my background, archaeologist, long-term historian, and I think there's some questions that we can understand. Oh, I'm supposed to be near the microphone, aren't I? Some questions I think we can understand properly only when we look at them on a really large scale, a global scale across the last, say, 20,000 years or more. And this, I think, is one of these problems. And this is one of the problems I write about in my new book, Foragers, Farmers, and Fossil Fuels. Now, in this book, the big question I'm addressing is why human values seem to vary so much across time and space, including the attitudes toward wealth inequality that I'm going to focus on this evening. But also, I talk about attitudes toward gender inequality, political inequality, and attitudes toward violence, because I think these things are all very bound up together. Now, the three concepts in the title of my book, this provides the basic tools I'm going to use to try to answer this question and the way I structure the talk tonight. Four parts to what I'm going to say. First, I'm going to talk about foragers. Then I'm going to talk about farmers. You're probably guessing the third part, yes, is going to be about fossil fuels. And then the last part, just some conclusions drawn out of this discussion. So I will get going, so we're not here all night. Foragers. Foragers are hunter-gatherers, just another word for hunter-gatherers. It had the merit of beginning with F, so it made for a nice title. Hunter-gatherers live off wild plants and wild animals. That's what defines you as a hunter-gatherer. Now, if you live off wild plants and animals, all kinds of consequences follow from this. One is you don't capture very much energy from the environment around you. Studies of modern hunter-gatherers show, depending on where you live, you capture somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000 kilocalories per person per day. Average person consumes something like 2,000 kilocalories as food, if you're taking all of your food in the form of plants at least. Then you've got the remainder of that 5,000 to 10,000. That goes to everything else you do. Your fuel, your clothing, your craft activities, everything is covered by that 5,000 to 10,000. The calculations, by the way, the calculations of energy capture, these come from another book I published a couple of years ago called The Measure of Civilization. Okay, so foraging yields relatively small amounts of energy, enough to live on, but small amounts. It has other requirements too, though. One is that foragers must live in very small groups of people. Typically, foragers will spend most of their lives in groups of, say, less than a dozen people. If you have groups bigger than that, it becomes very, very difficult to feed them from the amount of land you can cover as a foraging group with such low amounts of energy capture. Because you are relying on wild plants and wild animals, you have to be constantly moving around as well. Different plants ripen at different times, animals migrate, you're always on the move. You tend to cover huge areas. Typical foraging societies have population densities well under one person per square mile. Under one per 10 square miles is not that unusual. Usually moving around a lot in these little groups of 10, 12 people, occasionally coming together in larger groups, and here's a much-used picture from the Shoshone in the 1930s, come together in larger groups for religious activities and trading marriage partners. You've got to have a bigger gene pool, otherwise terrible things start to happen to you. So you come together for a small period, then fragment and spread out again. Now, in these societies, wealth is very limited, necessarily very limited, for a couple of simple reasons. One is that foraging doesn't allow you to produce enormous quantities of wealth. The other is, well, what would you do if you did? I mean, what if you produced huge quantities of wealth and built yourself a beautiful house in Pacific Heights or something? You can only stay there a couple of weeks. Then you're going to have to go someplace else to find the next batch of food. And maybe you can build a beautiful house in 50 different locations, but obviously getting a bit silly at that point. Material goods are a very different proposition when you're a highly mobile forager. What wealth there is tends to be naturally very small, very portable kinds of items. So wealth is very limited. Now, there are problems, or obvious problems, I think, when you start talking about, well, in comparative terms, I mean, what does it mean to say wealth is very limited? How wealthy are these people? But one economist, a guy named Angus Maddison, he tried to make a rough estimate of what would your income as a forager be roughly equivalent to in modern dollar terms. And yeah, I'm sure you can think of obvious problems with such a calculation. But the number Maddison came up with was something like $1.10 per day. That's about what you're making as a forager. You are very, very poor. So on the one hand, you're very poor. On the other hand, though, you are pretty much always very, very equal. The Gini coefficient, the average Gini coefficient for income in foraging societies, is around about 0.25. Mao's China, to remind you, is 0.31. 0.25, extremely low. So very little income inequality. Also, very little political inequality, very little gender inequality. These are very, very democratic societies, but very poor. And up till about 9,500 BC, everybody on Earth was a forager. And then shifts began as farming began to appear in the world. Farming, second category, farming comes into the world at the end of the Ice Age. When at the end of the Ice Age, as you can probably guess, the world warms up. That's what makes it the end of the Ice Age. Farming begins to be possible in certain parts of the world. Parts that in my books I like to call the lucky latitudes. Initially, it's a band of latitudes running from China to the Mediterranean and in the New World from Peru up to Mexico. Within these latitudes, there are quite a lot of plants and animals that lend themselves to what defines farming, which is access to domesticated plants and animals. You interfere with the reproduction of the plants and animals in ways, usually you don't actually know what you're doing, but ways that alter the genome. You produce the world's first genetically modified organisms, which yield much higher output to the humans than the wild versions did. And here you see a slide of fairly recent population engage in the sort of activities of cultivating wild gardens in New Guinea that probably led to the genetic changes that originally produced the domesticated plants and animals that we are now used to today. Wheat, barley, rice, sheep, goats, pigs. Pretty much everything we eat is domesticated plants and animals. And by meddling with the genomes, early farmers dramatically increased the yield they could get from domesticated plants and animals. The amount of energy they're capturing from the world around them jumps upward. And this... that's not supposed to happen. My slides went very peculiar here. Okay, well, pretend you can't see that. Pretend it's not there. It's not there. It didn't happen. The energy capture level jumps. The typical hunter-gatherer society, I was saying, they're in the 5 to 10,000 kilocalories per day range. Typical farming societies, well, they all fall between roughly 10,000 kilocalories per person per day and about 30,000, the most advanced farming societies. So very significantly more than the hunter-gatherer societies. So you get this big leap in the amount of energy being harvested, jump over that picture. But it goes along with a huge increase in the amount of work you've got to do. And the literature from peasant society is very, very clear on this. This is really, really hard work, being a peasant. If you're a forager, often, I mean, you're dirt poor, but often you will only actually be working, say, 2, 3, 4 hours a day. If you're a peasant, you are working really, really hard. So a big increase in the amount of work being done. Also a big increase in the division of labor. Here's some ancient examples. Aqueducts bringing water across what's now the deserts of North Africa to feed Roman cities. Here's a Roman ship dug up in the city of Pisa. Here's a model that Mussolini had built of the ancient city of Rome. You get this huge explosion in the scale of societies that's made possible and itself drives an increasingly complex division of labor, more and more energy capture, and at least to some extent higher levels of wealth as well. These populations become more and more sedentary. When you're a farmer, you just don't move around anywhere near as much. You start to get cities. The city of Rome had 1 million people. Up till quite recently, that was about as big as the cities could possibly get. Great increase in wealth in the farming societies as compared to the hunter-gatherers. According to the same economist, Angus Madison, the hunter-gatherer typical figure is something like $1.10 per day, average per capita income. Under farming societies, it moves up into the $1.50 to $2.20 range, which admittedly this is not going to last you very long in San Francisco. But you may be as much as, on average, twice as rich as the typical forager was. And I suspect this slide has gone mad as well. Oh no, this slide didn't go mad. So here's the typical forager income. These numbers are expressed in 1990 Geary Camus international dollars, if we have any economists in the audience. Jumps up to somewhere around $2 median income in the farming world. Also, though, huge increase in the concentration of wealth. Here, concentration of wealth. You don't get much more concentrated than King Tut. Huge increase in concentration of wealth. Goes along with a huge increase in political inequality as well as economic inequality. Tutankhamun wasn't just so rich that he was like a god. He was a god. He officially was a god. Created technical problems because when he ends up in the big gold box, because now the god is dead, you've got to have a new god. But the Egyptians were very, very good at finessing this transition. Massive increase in economic inequality and in political inequality. Huge increases in gender inequality. And the sort of what we nowadays tend to think of as sort of traditional gender arrangements, the man outside in the world, the woman inside the home. This is very much the legacy of farming societies. He's an ancient Athenian low relief representation of a woman sort of doing domestic duties back at home. Gender inequality soars, and also for the first time, a staple thing you find in almost every society, forced labor. Here's a Roman picture of prisoners being taken for slavery. Virtually every farming society uses forced labor of some kind. And all this goes along with an enormous leap in income inequality. Okay, this one came out right too. Typical Gini coefficient for the foragers, 0.25. The average for the farmers, I think, is something like 0.44. Major jump in inequality as you go into farming societies. Some places, like 18th century France, it goes up to 0.59. These are about as unequal as you can get in these societies. Well, why the change? I mean, this is obviously a very big change. If you're interested in human values, this is a very big change. Is it an obvious possibility? Is it that peasants are all really horrible people? That foragers are just really, really nice people, and peasants are brutish bullies. I mean, you can't see this very well. This guy actually really does look like a brutish bully. Brutish bullies are downtrodden doormats. Is this what happens? The nature of human personalities changes. Well, I don't think that's what happens. It's a little implausible. I don't think that's what happens. What I think does happen is that as societies have changed over thousands of years, as the amount of energy being harvested from the world changes over time, this drives the need to reorganize your society. It's really difficult to run a farming society in the same way as a hunter-gatherer society. If you don't have any hierarchy, if you don't have a strict gender division of labor, if you don't allow wealth inequality to start building, it's just really difficult to make these societies work. And one sign of that is the fact that it's almost impossible to find non-hierarchical farming societies. Another sign of that is it's almost impossible to find really hierarchical foraging societies. It seems to be the basic way, the things you have to do, the way you organize your society in order to pursue these economic strategies pushes you down these paths. As you get more and more to farming, pushes you down a path more and more toward inequality. And the way I think it worked out in practice, it's not like something magical about planting barley makes you a hierarchical person. I think it's more the case that over the 10,000 years of farming societies, probably every possible arrangement was tried out somewhere by somebody. But it's like a sort of evolutionary competitive process that's going on. if your society moves in directions which are not very competitive, say you have an unusually egalitarian farming society, you're going to struggle to compete with other farming societies which organize themselves in ways which work better in that world. And I suspect that what happens with values is that the more you tend to start saying, well, you know, I think hierarchy is good. I think it's absolutely natural. Women are inferior to men, should be kept in the house. If my wife argues with me, I should punch her in the mouth. If my children argue with me, I should flog them half to death. I should have a few slaves. The more you think that's right and proper, the more you're likely to flourish in a farming society. If you go around as a forager thinking all this stuff, you are not going to do very well at all. And if you go around as a farmer saying, hey, you know, let 1,000 flowers bloom, everyone should be equal, I will share my fields out with everybody else, this is just not going to go well. So I think it's driven by this very, very long-term kind of evolutionary competitive process of the attitudes and the organizations that work best tend to flourish more and gradually drive the alternatives out of business. And it is really hard to find exceptions to this. One that people will often point to, say an egalitarian farming society, is ancient Athens, the ancient Greek world, which George will be talking to you about very shortly, Pythagoras. They'll say, look at ancient Athens, the Athenians, farming society, they invented democracy. Yes, they did. But they also kept one-third of the population as slaves. They also said that no women have any political rights whatsoever. No women can transact an economic interaction rated, valued at more than the equivalent of about 2 days' wages for a laborer. This was a massively hierarchical society. Compared to other farming societies, yes, it looks pretty good. But compared to what I think most of us today think of as egalitarianism, very, very hierarchical. Okay, third part of the talk, the fossil fuels. This all changes once again very, very rapidly this time, around 200 years ago, with the coming of the Industrial Revolution. And what the Industrial Revolution basically means is releasing the energy trapped in coal. Foragers and farmers, what they're both doing is basically capturing sunshine, solar energy that's been converted into chemical and kinetic energy by plants and animals. You eat the plants and animals. What you do in a fossil fuel economy, you're doing the same thing, of course, but you're also capturing prehistoric sunshine. You're capturing all, well, not all, but a lot of the sunshine that fell on the Earth between 300 and 360 million years ago, produced all these trees which fall down, and if you can see the slide here, we've got leaf impressions on a lump of coal. The wood is compressed into coal in the Carboniferous era. If you can figure out how to release all that solar energy trapped in this dirty black coal, later in the dirty black oil, there's almost no limit to the amount of energy now available to you. And this is what happens a couple of hundred years ago in Northwest Europe, and particularly in Britain. People discover that machines can augment the power of muscles. Machines can burn coal to make steam, to do stuff that augments what humans can do. There's an explosion of energy. Oh, here, another slide gone mad here. Ignore that. Explosion of energy capture. It's telling you that with the farming societies, you're in the 10,000 to 30,000 kilocalorie range. In the US currently, we each burn up about 238,000 kilocalories of energy per day, which is a lot. And of course, most of that is not going directly into your mouth. You know, try as I might, I'm not able to do that. Most of it is going to power things like computers for PowerPoint projections, airplanes to fly us around the world. We burn astounding amounts of energy. There's never been anything like the Industrial Revolution in the history of the world. Explosion of energy. Accompanied by an explosion of incomes. Explosion of incomes. Here is the foragers on their $1.10 per day. Here is the farmers on their roughly $2 per day. This is global figures, by the way. There are the fossil fuelers on their roughly $25 per day. That's the global median income in 1990 US dollars at the moment. Explosion in the level of wealth when you compare the two right-hand columns. But, interesting thing, there's not an explosion in income inequality. This is a remarkable thing. I think if you were a space alien being told this story, you would say, well, as the economies get bigger and more complex and capture more energy, you go from foraging to farming, wealth rises, but so does inequality. You ramp it up again with the fossil fuel age, wealth rises, but inequality doesn't rise. This, I think, is the really interesting thing. This is a graph showing Gini scores from Britain, the heartland of the Industrial Revolution, from 1688 to 1913. And you see a clear curve on the graph. income inequality rises as we go into the late pre-fossil fuel period. Here we're getting into the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Here, the high point of the British Industrial Revolution, the age of Dickens, Marx, all these guys. But then it starts coming down again. And this is what economists call the Kuznets curve, after a famous economist who identified this pattern about 50 years ago. Income inequality starts coming down again. And it goes down further and further in the 20th century. What do we look at? Oh, yeah. Here we are. This is foragers, 0.25, farmers, 0.48 or something. And then here, a couple of different columns. I'll come back to why two columns in just a minute. But this is the Gini income scores for the OECD, basically the club of rich countries in the world back in the 1970s. Pre-tax income inequality has been driven back down to about, I think it's 0.39. Post-tax income inequality is down at about 0.26. It's back down in hunter-gatherer territory. This is a remarkable thing. Income inequality comes down sharply in the fossil fuel world. Democracy spreads, political inequality comes down, gender inequality comes down sharply as well. Remarkable things start to happen. You will all remember, I'm sure, the story of Bill Clinton, the most powerful man in the world, who was almost hounded out of office over allegations that he had sex with a young woman who worked for him. This guy, I'm sure many of you remember as well, this is Dominique Strauss-Kahn, who was hounded out of the top job at the IMF over allegations that he'd raped a hotel maid. Now, this did not happen to Roman emperors. If you wanted to rape a hotel maid, you raped a hotel maid. The world has changed faster in the last 200 years than ever before in its history. And why? Why has it changed in this particular direction? Is it that fossil fuel users are now, once again, all saints? We said, oh, farming is bad, hierarchy is bad, we must all be nice people. Well, again, you'll not be surprised to hear, I don't think that's the answer. I think when we look at the history, the last 200 years, what's been going on here, we see two big ideas about how do you organize these new fossil fuel societies? What do you do with all this stuff? I mean, fossil fuels allow you to build factories and produce staggering amounts of goods. People from any earlier age just would not believe the amount of stuff we have all over the world, even in poor countries, the amount of stuff that we've got. And because the factories provide all this power, you don't need anywhere near so many people working in the fields as you used to. I mean, in the US now, it's well under 2% of the population working in the fields. It used to be, until surprisingly recently, more than half the world's population are agricultural workers. So you've got factories producing all this stuff. You've got all these people not working in the fields, who work in factories, and then increasingly work in services, providing all these services that we need, things like Uber and stuff, without which we would all just cease to function, clearly. So you've got this world, vast amounts of goods and services. What do you do with them? This becomes the burning question in the 19th century. How do you organize this world of abundance? Now, one theory, very popular theory, is the way to make it work is top-down. You have highly centralized communist or fascist regimes. Here, Uncle Joe Stalin is the magnanimous dictator overseeing the whole thing. You have five-year plans telling everybody what to do. The government sets the price of everything, the value of everybody's labor. Everything is intensely centralized. So that's one theory. Billions of people lived by that theory for a long time. Billions actually still do. Second theory is, no, that's completely stupid. Don't do that. Second theory is you open everything up as much as possible. You free up everything. You liberalize. You have free markets, free speech. You see people being free marketeers in New York City. Free markets, free speech, free everything. The idea being that the more you open stuff up, the freer everybody will be to negotiate for the share of the wages they get. They'll generate the wealth they need to buy the goods and services. You don't tell people what to do. You leave it up to them to decide what to do. Two big theories of how to organize the world. And I think much like what I was saying about the shift in organization of values when you go from foragers to farmers, I think a similar sort of thing happens, but very, very quickly in the 19th and 20th centuries. You get this great competition between basically these two big ways of organizing a fossil fuel world. And the apparent verdict, I'll come back to in a second, but the apparent verdict of the 20th century, what people often call the Long War, 1914 through 1989, the apparent verdict is the open organization, the open society, is just much, much better at organizing a fossil fuel world than the top-down centralized version. This is the economy has become so complex that it's idiotic to try to tell everybody what to do. You leave people as much as possible to work it out for themselves. The idea being that this way of organizing things will generate affluent middle classes, a broad middle class that's got the amount of money they need to buy the goods and services being produced. Because let's face it, you can't get rich in a capitalist economy unless somebody is buying this stuff. Like, there's no point owning a million factories if nobody can afford to buy your stuff. So you must have this broad middle class that can afford to buy the goods and services that you're producing. So there's a pressure toward more income inequality, more income equality. But at the same time, you've got to have like entrepreneurial elites organizing, overseeing, and taking the risks in this system. And the general outcome of the 20th century struggle seems to have been that you have to allow the people doing the organizing to reward themselves materially. So there's a pressure away from income equality as well. You're being pulled in both directions, toward a less equal income world and a more equal income world. And this, I think, in some ways has been the big struggle going on within the capitalist way of organizing things. People learn in the late 19th century that you can't just rely on a laissez-faire system, just let people do whatever they want. And this is why on this graph I have the two columns for the 1970s OECD figure. This first column is what you get before taxes and other forms of wealth redistribution take place. You've got quite a high level of income inequality. I think it's 0.39, 0.40, something like that. This is the average for the OECD after governments have done their bit and moved the income around. They've driven it down. I think the figure at that point was actually 0.26. Governments intervene in this way because whatever they might say, they do think there is such a thing as a right level of inequality. They are deciding what that level should be, and they're taking institutional steps to try to push the society toward what they think is the right amount of inequality. Now, obviously, we're working it out as we go along. There's no rule book telling us how we do this. But working it out as we go along. And back in the 1970s, when post-tax OECD income inequality is down at this very low level, when this is Piketty's graph again, when the top the top 1% income is down at about 8% of the total income of the society, there are some signs that these Gini scores are often under 0.25. Maybe those were actually too low. And the reason I say, a couple of reasons why I say that. One is because the economic crises that erupt all over the capitalist world in the 1970s. The second is that it seems to me that people in the 1970s, in the late 70s, clearly thought these Gini scores were too low. You get a conservative backlash all across the democratic world. This is the Reagan-Thatcher era is ushered in. Voters decide to elect people who say, we're going to rearrange our society so the rich get richer. Most people implicitly, at least, seem to have agreed that 0.25 is too low for the Gini score. By the 2010s, though, here we are back over here, soaring back up, seem to be a number of signs that 0.35, which is the number we're heading towards, 0.25 too low, 0.35, maybe that's too high. We're now getting a whole new set of very different economic crises breaking on us. And once again, it seems like voters beginning to turn away from the people who at least explicitly are saying, hey, I'm happy to see an inequality. Income inequality has become one of the big political issues. So the conclusion I would draw from that is that each of these systems of generating energy, capturing energy, organizing society, each of them has a kind of optimality band for income inequality. There's such a thing as being too equal. There's such a thing as being too unequal. And the more you fall in the right band, the more successful your society is going to be. And the right amount of income inequality for our society, I think this one, yeah, this one's gone mad again, we'll ignore that. The right amount for our society is a score between 0.25 and 0.35. Now, okay, so much for that. Piketty says there's only one way to get to that, and that is to have another world war. Now, that is not very cheerful. I'm a bit more upbeat about this. I don't think that's the only way to get there. I think it's a way to get there. I think he's quite right about the mechanism of the 20th century that redistributed the wealth so much. It really was the world wars. That's a way to get there. But it's not the only way to get there. And last Yes, last year I published another book, which I spoke here at the Commonwealth Club about, called, called War, What Is It Good For? A very cheerful book about the history of war. But one of the things that I was talking about in that is something that a number of social scientists have been trying to demonstrate recently, which is that rates of violent death among humanity have plummeted across the last 10,000 years. This is one of the things about foragers. I mean, when I'm teaching about foragers at Stanford, so much about them seems to appeal to our students, the egalitarianism, the sort of proto-democracy. It all sounds great until we come to the point that if you had been a hunter-gatherer, you stood a chance of dying violently somewhere between 1 in 10 and 1 in 5. These are really rough places. If you lived in the 20th century, two world wars, nuclear weapons used, genocides, all kinds of really bad stuff, your chance of dying violently is somewhere between 1 in 100 and 1 in 50. One-tenth the level you face as a hunter-gatherer. Dramatic change, and it's even lower now. It's well under 1% now, according to the World Health Organization. Dramatic changes. And one of the lessons I think we can draw from that is that humanity has learned to master violence. And there's a good reason to think that we may be able to do the kinds of things that bring down income inequality without having to do the unpleasant stuff of killing everybody to go along with it. So, okay, to wrap up, a couple of speculations I'd like to draw out of what I'm saying to close for today, draw this long-term history of inequality. First of these takes me back to China, where I left Monsieur Piketty and myself holding forth in China, explaining all the problems of the world, and having lunch too. Now, Piketty's argument was that the verdict of the great wars of the 20th century was that, the verdict of the great wars of the 20th century was that the open, liberalized, capitalist ways of organizing a fossil fuel economy work better than any others. Well, obvious problem saying that's here in Beijing. They actually don't agree with that. What about the People's Republic of China? And one of the big debates in political science circles these days is it the case that China has found what they sometimes call the Beijing consensus, a new way of running a sort of somewhat capitalist society, fossil fuel society, generating enormous amounts of wealth, but with a centralized one-party state? Have they found a whole new way of doing things, an alternative to democracy and liberalism? Well, the implication of what I've just been saying is that the answer is no, they haven't done this. Other things being equal, the more that China liberalizes, the better it's going to do as a fossil fuel economy. If it can't liberalize, it's unlikely to succeed. This, I think, is the lesson of the last 10,000 years of history. And I think perhaps also the lesson of what we've seen recently with Japan and India as well, that the more you're able to liberalize your economies, the better they do once you've grabbed the really low-hanging fruit, which I would say is what China's been doing since the 1970s. So that's one speculation. It seems to me that if China is going to continue with this economic growth, they are going to have to liberalize their institutions. Otherwise, it's all going to go very badly, other things being equal. But the second speculation is on, will other things be equal? And here I can for once give you a clear answer. No, they won't. Other things have never been equal in the entire history of the planet. They are not about to become so just to convenience me. I've been suggesting that the scale of energy capture determines the most successful ways of organizing society, which reward the kinds of values that fit in best with those societies. I mean, like, if you were to run for mayor of San Francisco on a peasant platform saying, women back in the home, there is only one true God and he is me, things like this, you're not going to do very well. You have to, if you want to succeed in our world, you have to adapt to the kind of values that flourish in this world. So I've been suggesting this is the process that's been going along. And now, one of the big things that I think all of us are aware is happening now in the 21st century, energy capture is changing faster than it ever has done before, even during the heyday of the Industrial Revolution. We are shifting away from fossil fuels at a pace that I think 50 years ago would have seemed unimaginable. Still a very long way to go, but this is happening. I think it's a cause for some celebration. Now, if my argument is right, the fact that we are transforming our energy capture, an optimistic view, we're changing toward non-polluting sources that will provide vastly more energy than we've ever had before. I mean, we capture something like 1/1,000,000,000th of the solar energy that falls on the surface of our planet every day. So if this is the direction we're moving in, then we should probably expect the organization of our societies and their values also to change at a lightning rate in the 21st century. Energy capture, as I say, changing faster than ever before. Here's another graph that worked. This is a graph showing you energy capture per person in the kind of most efficient societies in the world, 14,000 BC to the year 2000 AD, thousands of kilocalories per person per day on a logarithmic scale. So you go from 1 to 10 here, 10 to 100 there, 100 to 1,000 there. And you see the way it just explodes almost vertically when we have the Industrial Revolution. If we make a really conservative estimate, let's just say energy capture continues going up in the 21st century at the same speed it did in the 20th century, what we get is that sort of exponential jump just being extended even further. You see, dramatic leap. We're going to be talking about a world where we are each burning through 4 or 5 times as much energy as we are in the world today. And, of course, we will be doing this from non-fossil fuel sources. Otherwise, we'll die. You can't have, here's the number, 575,000 kilocalories per person per day. You cannot have 10 billion people burning that on fossil fuels. You boil and poison yourself. Now, there's much talk around this part of the country about the alternatives and about moving into a fossil fuel post-fossil fuel age. What will that mean for inequality? And Well, talking about that, of course, this is total speculation. But actually, I think it's not totally crazy, I think, to suggest some of the things I'm suggesting. One of the biggest things I think is likely to change if we do move toward that kind of world. Obvious question, what will we do with all that energy? And I think the obvious answer is we have built machines that can suck up all of that and more. I think that is what we'll primarily do with the energy. We will fuel our technological supercomputer revolution with it. There are technologies being developed at the moment that are already, as many of you will know, they're eroding the boundaries between people and the machines we've created. And I suspect this is going to be the big transformation in the coming century. And we're breaking down the boundaries between mind and machine. We are generating forms of what we sort of condescendingly call artificial intelligence. It isn't artificial intelligence. It's just different intelligence. Probably a computer will never be exactly the same as you and me, but it's not going to care. It's going to be much smarter than you and me. We have synthesized life. We have become God. We have made life in Silicon Valley. It's not very impressive life, but we have made it all the same. I went to a talk recently in Washington by somebody from DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, talking about brain-to-brain interfacing, by which she meant she is confident that within 20 years or so, we will have fairly basic and rickety technology, but technology that makes it possible to read the electrical signals that are moving around inside your head. You know, when you think, this is what it is, electrical signals flashing between your neurons, which your body then tells you how to turn into this torrent of words coming out of my mouth. But you don't have to do that. You can read the signals in the brain, transmit them over the internet directly into somebody else's brain, and they get the message almost instantaneously with no distortion whatsoever. The army loves this. I mean, what could possibly be better for dispelling the fog of war? But she was absolutely confident. We're going to have something. It'll be crude, but we will have begun within 20 years. We are shifting the boundaries, and we're moving toward living increasingly in a virtual, not a physical space. Now, all of these things, it's all early days yet, but really, we ain't seen nothing yet. So the 21st century is going to be the age of science fiction. It's going to be like a magical kingdom to anybody from any earlier society. Now, if any of that stuff comes true, the 21st century promises or threatens to be the greatest transformation in the history of the world. Some would say it promises to be the end of human history altogether. Human beings will simply not be what they are now, 100 years from now. A century from now, worrying about the right amount of inequality for a fossil fuel society is probably going to be as irrelevant as worrying about the right amount of inequality for Neanderthals. I mean, it's simply not going to be a part of people's world. Worrying about what sort of attitudes you should have to the sort of inequality that we are facing. Final question to close up with. Where would we put a post-fossil fuel world on? I think I forgot to put my last slide in. Where do you go? Help. There we go. Where would a post-fossil fuel world fit on a graph like this? And I want to close with two guesses about what it might mean. One possibility. What might inequality mean if we've all been beamed up to the great database in the sky? All our minds are melded together. We are one giant silicon-based superorganism. What would income inequality mean in a context like that? And I confess, I have absolutely no idea. Which makes me think if that is the direction the world is going in, the whole discussion about income inequality is relatively quickly going to become beside the point. Other possibility, though. What if we don't all beam up to the great database in the sky quite as fast as each other, which I think is not a crazy possibility? What if some people who are extremely rich have access to the kinds of technologies that will allow you to augment your basic humanity long before the rest of us do this? What if some of us start to become post-human beings with powers that we can only dream of? Now, there's a famous story that F. Scott Fitzgerald is supposed to have said once at a party, that the rich are different from us, to which Ernest Hemingway replied with this great put-down, yes, they have more money. Now, I think in the sort of world I'm talking about here, the rich really are going to be different from us, if this is the way things go. You are going to have rich people with thinking power. Well, they're not really going to be rich people anymore, are they? With beings with thinking power, trillions of times what is available to we mere unaugmented, carbon-based, sloppy, blood-filled human beings. They're going to be as far beyond us as we are beyond single-celled organisms. Thinking that we will not conclude that hierarchy and inequality are a good idea in that world strikes me as very implausible. So there's something to think about. So thank you very much for listening. Thank you.
I'd like to remind our audiences that they're listening to Professor Ian Morris from Stanford speaking about his latest book, Foragers, Farmers, and Fossil Fuels. Mark Twain isn't known as an economist, but he did react to the whole discussion about socialism and Karl Marx and everything in the late 19th century by saying that if you took all the money in the world and you divided it equally with all the people, it would take about 3 years before it was back in the same hands again. And you know, this is sort of what you're talking about too. This part of the inequality is that people with the skills and grab what they want and et cetera, et cetera. So. It was an excellent talk, and we have only a little time for questions because we filled the time, but let's take those questions.
Thank you very much. What do you, where do you place atomic energy in this picture?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question. Yeah, where does nuclear energy fit into this picture? And nuclear energy, of course, is a non-fossil fuel source of energy, and one of the great hopes when nuclear power initially came in, it was that, you know, here is this substitute for coal and oil. It will be much less polluting, and you know, potentially it has the potential to unleash staggering amounts of energy. But of course, people then soured very seriously on nuclear energy, particularly in the US, of course, after the Three Mile Island accident. And so now there's a lot less nuclear energy around than before. And because one of the main reasons, people are basically saying that, yeah, okay, nuclear energy is really, really clean until it isn't. And when it stops being clean, it's way worse than coal and oil. And I know this is probably not the right audience to say this to, but I'm a big fan of nuclear energy. But I don't see it coming back anytime soon. But actually, I can use your question to just elaborate slightly on what I'm saying. I mean, when I talk about foragers, farmers, and fossil fuels, using that as a kind of shorthand for what I think is the real process going on here, which is just that as energy capture goes up, you have to change the way you organize your societies and the values that you have. And it's not quite as clear-cut as foraging, farming, and fossil fuels, but it actually maps on almost exactly onto these categories. So, yeah, I think the initial use of nuclear energy is going on very much within a fossil fuel context. I think it had the potential to transform that context, but the risks, most people have concluded, are too high.
All right. My question is kind of about the causation and timelines. And we talk about how, you know, the society that's organized kind of reflects the economic system. But doesn't the United States, when it became its own country, kind of go against that because you had what was still a highly collectivized economic system where you had slavery and plantations and things like that, but yet the political elite did create a very egalitarian political system?
Yeah. The U.S. is a really interesting example in all kinds of ways. And One of the most controversial things, as you may well know, one of the most controversial things about the slave agricultural system in the South is a number of economists have looked at this and said, you know, that was a stunningly efficient economic system. That slaves, when you compare slave agriculture in the South to free agriculture in the North, there's a lot of variations in the North, but much of the time, the slaves in the South are generating not just sort of more overall wealth, because obviously well, part of that is the fact that slaves are getting paid so poorly. But they are, even when you sort of correct for the different income levels of free Northerners and enslaved Southerners. And the slave system was just an extraordinarily efficient way to generate wealth if you're growing cotton for a global market. And I think it's very much a legacy of the farming era. And I think this is one of the reasons why historians have had so much trouble analyzing the southern plantation system. That on the one hand, you get guys like there's a famous Marxist historian, Eugene Genovese. He wrote some wonderful books. He wrote this book, Roll Jordan Roll, and the thesis in that book was that the slave system is this sort of leftover from the past. It was doomed to disappear because it's simply a leftover from the past. It had no world in the, no place in the 19th century world. The economic historians were pointing out, well, hey, it was stunningly efficient. And I think I would say that what happens is that as you start to move into a fossil fuel world, and this fossil fuel global economy starts developing, there's less and less place in it for the use of forced labor. And you start to get competition mounting, pressure mounting from non-slave-based societies who don't like the slave systems because they're creating all kinds of distortions in the global economy. The disappearance of forced labor around the world was up to the point that it happened. No major change in the history of the world had ever happened that fast. Like by, I'll probably get the dates all totally wrong, but by the, I think it's 1860s when U.S. slavery drops out, slavery and serfdom have almost disappeared everywhere. I think 1888, I think Brazil is the last big slave economy that goes. I think the British banned the slave trade in 1809. They banned it in the whole empire, I think, sometime in the 1860s. The course of a century, legalized slavery disappears almost everywhere on the planet. I mean, obviously, there are some leftovers. But it disappears almost everywhere on the planet. Nothing like that had ever happened before. No major social change like that. It's the fastest major social change in the history of the world until the gender equalization of the 20th century, which is even faster. Just an extraordinary thing. So, yeah, I think you're right to ask about slavery. I think this is one of the big issues for any kind of theory like this.
So thank you very much for bringing some really interesting ideas to the front.
Oh, thank you.
I have a question about the Gini coefficient for Scandinavian countries because they do have a lot of gender equality. They have more a bigger safety net, and they also have a very high
Yes, I do.
A lot of happy people who live there. They're one of the happiest nations in the world. So they seem to have found the golden mean. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, Scandinavia, just fascinating place. I mean, partly because I have quite a few Swedish and Norwegian friends. But, yeah, fascinating place. Has, yeah, one of the best safety nets in the world, as you say. It has one of the obviously different countries there, but they have among the highest median incomes anywhere in the world. I think I'm right that they have one of the lowest Gini scores for income inequality. But interesting and weird thing, they have one of the highest levels of wealth inequality, meaning like your personal savings and assets, one of the highest levels of wealth inequality in the world, which is a really weird thing. And gosh, I read a paper about this just recently trying to explain why this was. I've now totally forgotten what the guy said. But, yeah, people cleverer than me argue about why that is. But, yeah, very weird place. But I think the other weird thing about Scandinavia, of course, is they're all supposed to be so damn happy, yet they all kill themselves all the time. What is that about? I don't know. The ones that are left are happy. Yes, maybe that's the answer.
All right, time for one more question.
Thank you. So a lot of millennials right now are moving back to almost idealizing foragers or farming. And so, you know, the movement of making things on our own and wanting to be more equal and flat in society. Where do you see that movement fitting into the fact that, you know, science is just taking us to a post-human in rapid speed?
Yeah. I think I mean, I think you're absolutely right about this. I think certainly it's something I encounter a lot with the students I teach. And actually, an interesting encounter with it, I last year did a little stint as a visiting professor at a business school in Switzerland in their executive MBA program, talking about some of this stuff. And I was very surprised how... I mean, I think people have been pretty sincere how very, very serious about equality people were. Maybe this is a feature of Swiss business schools, I don't know, but very, very serious about this. But yeah, I guess one of the things we talked about in the, like, it's a three-day thing we did at this business school, and one of the things we talked about a lot there was this question of, you know, will a movement, if this is what happens, will a movement toward a post-fossil fuel world with even more abundant energy than we're used to now, will that just produce, like the fossil fuel world, but say, you know, fossil fuel world on steroids, that all the urges toward equality, which have now become so ingrained over so much of the world, will it just go further and further, so that everybody thinks, well, of course, democracy is the only possible system. Everybody thinks, well, yes, of course, men and women are equally well-equipped to do any kind of work they want to. You know, everybody thinks we should have as little income inequality as possible. Yeah, is that the way it's going? Or something I actually didn't really say much about in the talk, but will we see the kinds of increasing income inequality we've seen over the last 40 years? Is that actually what the future holds? You know, regardless of all my guff about, you know, being beamed up into the sky, even if we don't do any of that stuff, are we still going to see the emergence and consolidation of a small global Anglophone elite who spend their entire lives in first-class lounges at airports, you know, tweeting each other? Is this what's going to happen? They are going to pull away from the rest of us, as Piketty predicts, and get concentrations of riches to the point that the rest of us start to say, well, yes, of course, this is the world we live in. We're just going to have to suck it up now. And because if I had the answer, or if I had an answer that could convince everybody else I was right, I would be part of that elite by now, and I wouldn't have to be here tonight talking to you guys. So, of course, I don't know. I mean, my impression is, in the relatively short term, I think we're going to be moving toward an increasingly egalitarian, liberalized world. Like I say, in the next generation, I think that's what's going to happen. In the next two generations, my guess would be that's probably what's going to happen. But the next three generations, maybe not.
But thank you very much. Yeah, thank you very much, Professor Morris. And Professor Morris's book is available for sale. Those of you who would like to help him move into that elite can buy it afterwards, and he will be happy to sign the book. And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 114th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much.